Radio, where gamers roll.
www.d20radio.com.
Hello and welcome to the Knowledge Check Podcast, a D&D 5th edition discussion podcast. I am one of your hosts, Eric.
And I'm Philip.
And welcome to the 12th episode of the Knowledge Check. We hit a dozen, finally. We have a pretty interesting episode. We've had some people through either email or the website reach out to us asking more questions about this campaign that Philip and I keep going on and on about. And so we thought we would structure us discussing that campaign around running a long game. It's one that's going to last a few years as opposed to a few months. And really, I mean, rarely campaigns hit those top tier levels. And we're talking about those games where you do accomplish that and the players have hit god level power a lot of times, especially if they're a wizard, which we will get into that. But before we get into all of that, first, the social media plug, of course. So, Philip, where can they find us?
On all the media's social. We are on Google+, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, all the usual places at The Geek Pantheon. You can also email us at thegeekpantheon@gmail.com. If you want to get in touch that way.
And you can also contact us through our website, thegeekpantheon.com.
Yes, and that, we have a website.
Yes. And that is where you can get all of the latest episodes from our various shows the very second that they come out, if you want to do it that way. Now let's get into some notable news and just things that piqued our interest since the last time we did this, Philip. So, indeed. You were telling me...
Yes. There's some D&D Beyond news that has come out since last time. We have got a pricing structure now. It looks like the pricing structure for D&D Beyond will be... I'm not sure how these two pricing forms interact, but there's a subscription. There's two tiers of subscription. And then there's also a pricing structure for the various supplements.
And we just want to point out, we're getting this information from a non-wizard source, correct? So
yeah,
take this with a grain of salt.
Yeah, this has been on Reddit. This was on Google+. And I'm finding it on some general frequently asked questions stuff about Beyond, but it hasn't actually shown up on wizards.com yet. So... it's possible this is uncertain. I'm not sure. But anyway, what we're seeing is that there is a two-tier subscription with a heroic tier that's intended for an individual player, and it's $2.99 a month. And basically, that lets you use the site ad-free and also add homebrew stuff to your tool set and to create an unlimited number of characters. So that seems to say that you'll be able to use the tool set free, but it will have ads and you'll be limited on how many characters you can create. Presumably, what you'll have access to on the free version is all the stuff that's in the SRD that they released, the things that have been free and the things that were in Beyond's beta initial release. There's also a master tier. It's more intended for a DM, and basically the idea is you pay $5.99 a month, and then you can share your content with your gaming group. So if you're a DM and you want to make use of this and you want your players to all be on the same page, then rather having to get all your players to subscribe, you can get a master tier subscription and share it all with your players, which I think is a really good option to have. I like it when various virtual tools have that option. And it's usually quite a lot more expensive than this, so that's pretty good. Now the downside. Mm. So the subscription, that's pretty mild. On the other hand, there is a cost for all of the D&D supplements. You have to repurchase them in digital form if you already have them in physical form. So, for example, source books like the Player's Handbook, Volo's Guide to Monsters, these will cost $29.99 to add to your D&D Beyond account. Adventure modules such as Curse of Strahd or Storm King's Thunder will be $24.99. However, for the first week after they launch, the Player's Handbook, the Dungeon Master's Guide, and the Monster Manual will be on sale for $19.99. So you'll be able to save $10 on that. So we have a pretty mild subscription, especially compared to what did they call the fourth edition one?
D&D Insider.
Insider, yeah. Especially compared to that. But what you're getting for that subscription is a lot less because D&D Insider allowed you to have access to everything new that had come out in those tool sets. You obviously didn't get digital copies of the book, and it's not entirely clear to me what you get there or if you're just unlocking the content or if you actually have a digital copy.
Yeah.
So there's still a lot to this that's not totally clear, but it does look like from what we're seeing right now that you will need to purchase an unlock of all of the books if you want to make use of anything beyond homebrew content and content from the SRD.
See, and I wish that there was some way to not force people to double purchase. Like if I go out and buy the hardcover version of a book, I feel like I should have access to that content in D&D Beyond. And I mean, whether that's including a unique code like in each book or what, I don't know. But yeah, that's my biggest disappointment is obviously they can't give all of the content away for free to everybody. I understand that. But if I've already purchased the Monster Manual, I don't feel like I should have to pay even the discounted pricing of $20 to have access to that same content. You're just saving me time. You're not giving me anything for my money.
Right. Well, and also there's the very real question of with Insider, eventually Wizards just kind of gave up on it.
Yeah.
Like they supported it for a long time, but eventually they gave up on it and stopped providing any updates to it, stopped supporting it entirely. So what happens then if we get to that point in the cycle? We get along to the next D&D edition and Wizards doesn't want to support this anymore. What happens to your content then? Do you also have PDFs here? I want some more information before I make a final judgment, but yeah, I agree that this doesn't sound awesome.
And I feel like especially me, I'm about to get real negative Nancy with everybody. Just acknowledging I like Wizards of the Coast. I like their products generally. But I do have some, I love D&D Beyond. I've loved being a part of the beta. I love the concept of it. I was very excited about it. But the fact that as a dungeon master, especially, and I feel like probably at least the majority of our audience, you all are dungeon masters. The fact that I have to pay a $6 a month subscription and then on top of that, spend money buying the rights to all of the books that have already come out if I'm wanting all of that content to use. And then on top of my subscription moving forward, having to then purchase the book itself and then the rights to use the content from the books in D&D Beyond, there has to be a better way to profit off of this without clearly price gouging people so massively.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I feel like if the subscription were $10 a month and they attached on that, you get all of the books as they release included. They don't release books that often. So an extra $3 a month probably makes up the cost that you would be paying for an additional supplement or book when it comes out. So they're making the same money. You're spending the same money, but it seems like a better deal. And that's such an easy fix. Like,
yeah.
And I would have no problem with that. Like, $10 a month for everything D&D. Cool. But yeah, that's where I'm coming from on it.
Well, and with that model, if your group stops playing for a while, goes on hiatus, changes systems, something happens that you're not using this anymore, you just stop the subscription.
Yeah.
Which is why that seems like a better deal, because you have an out. Or for that matter, if it turns out the Wizards doesn't hold up supporting the tool, doesn't keep updating it, and it gets, or there's a really big lag with releasing the digital content, like that, like happened quite often in fourth edition. Wizards just doesn't have the track record with digital tools for D&D to get my immediate buy-in on this yet.
Yeah. And also that they haven't announced, I feel like it would be smart and it would be easy to get initial buy-in from people and get people using it. And a lot of digital tabletops and products like this have this option. Like, give me $100 lifetime membership or even $150, yeah. Like an upfront, I pay this amount of money and I get everything for life. And then you like, on Wizard's side, you eliminate somebody's ability to opt out after a couple months if they don't like the product. Well, I paid for it, so I might as well keep using it rather than paying for another product that I might like the tools a little bit better. I've already bought into this one. So yeah. We don't need to get into marketing strategy for Wizards, though. Needless to say, I am disappointed in the information coming out. That's just where I'm coming from, is I'm sad because I was really excited about D&D Beyond. But if the pricing doesn't change, then I probably won't be using it except for the free version because I like the tools.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the reason that they are locking homebrew content, like when we were initially discussing that, I was like, that seems so dumb. But how easy would it be for me to go out and buy Storm King's Thunder and spend an afternoon quote-unquote creating homebrew content that's all the Storm King's Thunder stuff and then just using it. So, you know, I get it, but at the same time, I don't like it. So,
yeah.
Anyway, anything else about D&D Beyond you'd like to say, Philip?
No, I think that about sums it up. We'll hopefully get some more official announcement kind of information.
Yeah.
Since it's not that far from launch.
Yeah.
So hopefully we'll get some more information soon and it will clear up some of the unknown aspects of this.
Yeah. Okay. Well, in addition to all the information coming out about D&D Beyond, we also got a new Dragon Plus magazine, which is always fun. It even has an adventure in it, Philip, so you can be happy about that.
Yay.
Although I'm not sure it's one that's particularly your cup of tea, but we'll see when we get into it.
Is it a big, long dungeon crawl?
No, it is not, actually.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, in this issue, we have articles about just different D&D experiences around the globe, just interviewing people from all over. Chris Perkins and Adam Lee take you inside the development of Tomb of Annihilation. They actually did a competitive version of Tomb of Horrors at Gary Con 9. And they put a new updated version of the module's original intro poem in this magazine. Wizards put a call out to the community to come up with some cool ideas for lich phylacteries. And so just reading through it, some of the highlights for me were an artificial eye implanted in a beholder, an amethyst embedded in the centerpiece of a beautiful golden necklace given to the queen of the realm on the day of her wedding, a single coin in a dragon's hoard.
That's nasty.
Yeah. This one's really cool. An ornate music box enchanted to disorient anyone who opens it, causing them to forget that they ever found it. So yeah, it's just some really cool stuff. We also got another painting tutorial where master painter Daniel Gellin tackles the intricacies of painting translucent plastic figures, which, Philip, as a painter, you could probably discuss at length. Well, Wizards has an article for you. We also got some maps, which was in last month's as well, just pulling maps out of the Awning Portal, putting up digital versions. This month we got the Sunless Citadel and the Hidden Shrine of Tomoachan, and then also some boat maps, which is cool, and a hex map of a small grouping of islands. And then the module, which is titled The Hangover. It was written by Curtis Wiebe, not sure how to pronounce it, W-I-E-B-E. Weeby, maybe. But he actually does a comic for Image Comics titled Rat Queens, which is about an all-female adventuring party. It's kind of crass and just over the top. But he did a module to play as those characters if you want. And the article includes character sheets for them, or obviously you could just play as your group. But it is... It kicks off with a night of partying and just going crazy. And the party wakes up in the middle of the forest in a very dire situation. Bum, bum, bum. So,
classic.
Yep. So head on over to... They also do have the disclaimer. This module is intended for mature audiences only. So go into it with that in mind. But head on over to dragonmag.com to check out the latest Dragon Plus magazine. Also, Wizard of the Coast gave us another plane shift. This was actually before we recorded the last episode, but we missed it. It is, once again, their ongoing series of adapting Magic the Gathering stuff into D&D. And this is for the country or realm, or I'm not familiar enough with Magic the Gathering to know, Amonkhet, which is fantasy Egypt. But the whole culture surrounds itself around the idea of these five trials. And so everybody has to undergo the trials. When you complete one, you get a badge that you take with you into the afterlife. And that kind of dictates how you're treated. And so it's solidarity, knowledge, strength, ambition, and zeal. And so it's cool. They even provide some racial tweaks for if you want to play a person from this country with new personality, ideal, and bond and flaw tables to roll on. So, yeah, it's cool. And there's even a background called the Vizier, where you are a servant of your god and perform tasks that are essential to facilitating initiate's journey through your god's trial and stuff like that. And so it's neat. And it gives you a feature called Voice of Authority, where basically when you talk, people think that you are speaking for a god. So at least people of that culture. So... Yeah, I mean, it's really cool. It's very dense. Like the previous ones, they take some of the stuff that already exists in D&D and adapt it if you're wanting to play in this realm. Or by the same token, if you want to pull this stuff into your existing campaign. If you want your party to find themselves in Amonkhet, then you can do it. They also introduce a new race called the Aven, which have human-like bodies, arms, legs, and bird-like wings and heads. So kind of that classic Egyptian hieroglyphic look of just the dude with the falcon head. So, yeah, I mean, definitely go check it out over at Wizards of the Coast, their D&D website. Also, we'd like to just acknowledge that we are part of the D20 Radio Network of podcasts. And if you want to head on over to d20radio.com, it is the best little gaming blog on the web with articles coming out every day just to fulfill your gaming itch. And this week, on July 18th, Ben Erickson, who we have talked about, I think, every time we mention an article from D20 Radio, because he puts out great D&D content, has an article from his workshop series featuring Gralbeck, the Bugbear Cleric of Deceit. And this isn't a monster card. It is purely flavor, but it's the history of this Bugbear Cleric and how he came to become a cleric in the first place, and then also the deception of it all. And also some tips if you want to turn Gralbeck into like a really formidable opponent. So yeah, it's a really cool article. Ben is doing some great stuff over there. So definitely go check it out. And as Philip and I have done the past couple episodes, one episode, I don't know when we started this, I got something from the DMs Guild I want to talk about, which is Nurzugal, maybe? Nurzugal's Dungeon Master Toolkit. Given what we're going to be talking about in this episode, I felt like this was a good, appropriate item. It is pay what you want, like the last one that we did, and this includes random D100 tables for encounters, items, beneficial effects, detrimental effects, for armor, weapons, I mean, all kinds of rollable tables. And I love me a rollable encounter table. Just because, like, you're wandering through a forest, you know that you want the party to do something on the way to this thing. And so you just roll on this thing, and if you land on a 34, they find a paladin out in the wild searching for a nearby demon he must vanquish. Boom. There's a little mini adventure. If you roll a 13, ironically, it says bad luck, incredibly difficult monster encounter. And so, yeah, it's really cool. It also includes a couple complete dungeons, because Philip just loves himself a dungeon crawl. but it has background overview of the dungeon, what kind of enemies you're going to find in there, maps, which admittedly are hand drawn, but you don't got to do it. and then it also includes some puzzles, which is really cool. Including the 7-digit puzzle, the bucket conundrum, the path of many letters. So if you really hate coming up with puzzles for your party to do, Philip, then this is a good resource to just be able to pull something and stick it in wherever you like. Nice. So yeah, definitely go check it out. Like I said, it's Nurzugal. Let me give you the spelling, everybody, because I clearly can't say the name. Nurzugals, Nurzugal's DM toolkit over on the DMs Guild. So yeah, that is all of the things that I found this week that I thought were neat. So,
hooray.
You want to get into the main event, Philip?
Sure.
Okay.
So, we have mentioned many times this lengthy campaign that we ran in the Eberron setting and its ill-fated sequel. And we thought that it would be an interesting set of episodes to talk a little bit about both the successful and the failed campaign that we ran. So today we're going to start talking about the successful one. And the kind of common theme here is the long campaign. Which I think is probably the ultimate goal of most DMs. I don't think anyone starts off with like, you know what, I want to run a game. Well, not anyone. I think most of the time when you and your friends decide to play D&D, once you figure out you like it, you're probably not thinking, you know, I want to play a game that's going to last for 6 sessions and then we'll just stop.
Yeah. You're thinking in terms of years and getting all the way to level 20. And sadly for me and Philip, our very first campaign managed to do that. And we have been nothing but disappointed ever since.
So one of the facts about our game is that we didn't set out to do that. Like,
yeah,
we were new to D&D And we set out to, we just wanted to play. It didn't, honestly, Eric and I probably couldn't have given you the term campaign when we started doing this. We just, we decided where we were going to play and started playing. So we kind of lucked into it. And so a lot of this is us examining the perfectly intact black box from our perfectly intact, successfully landed plane and seeing if we can glean out what it was that we did right that allowed the game to turn out so successfully, because a lot of it wasn't on purpose.
Yeah.
And see if we can get some guidance from that. So this is the long campaign, part one, Unfinished Wars.
Ooh. And I
feel
think
like Eric needs a special music cue.
Music right drop.
Here. Yeah.
I will go hit up Kevin MacLeod and see if I can find anything. No, I think just all of the information that we are about to give to you all needs to be framed in a very specific light. And that light being that Philip and I were also incredibly lucky in that we had a table full of players that completely trusted us. There was no questioning. They knew that we were doing everything we could to tell a good and compelling story. And that is not something that a lot of tables have the benefit of. So,
and with one exception, we knew them all very well.
Yeah.
I think there's only one person who we came to be friends with by playing this game.
Mm-hmm.
And that was Randy, who plays on
Eberron Renewed.
On Eberron Renewed now. So, okay. So first, a few simple realities about a long game. Most campaigns don't finish. The vast majority of campaigns that you start will not finish. I mean, you look at people out there that we kind of, we D&D nerds kind of hold up as the great GMs. And I was watching, if you like 5th edition, you probably watch or are aware of Critical Role. But I was watching an interview with Matt Mercer, the DM on Critical Role, about their current arc, and the players are currently, the characters are currently level 17 and 18. So they're very high level. And they're going after deity level dangers. And he was talking about that and basically said, look, this is uncharted territory for me.
Yeah.
The campaigns that I've run, they don't make it this far. So that said to me that even a very, very good DM, and I think it would be hard to argue that Matt Mercer is anything but a good DM, you just don't most of the time you just don't finish. So I guess all that's kind of a caveat to say, we're going to suggest some things that caused our game to succeed, but this is not by no means a recipe for a 3-year campaign. The truth will probably still be that most campaigns will not finish.
Mm-hmm.
And the reasons for that are very simple. Players and DMs get burned out. You don't want to play anymore. I think probably the number one cause of a campaign to end is changing life circumstances.
Yeah.
You move, you get married, you get a new job that doesn't allow you to do this anymore. You have kids and the time is just isn't there. I remember a very distinct moment when, and if she's, I don't think that this person listens to this, but in the event that she does, she probably has never heard this story before. And I feel a little bit bad about it, but, one of the players in our game, playing Annie, who you'll hear about here in a little bit, she became pregnant. She and her husband were expecting their first kid. And she told us this, me and Eric, at the same lunch. And after the lunch, Eric and I were standing outside. and I looked over at Eric and said, so there's a deadline now.
Yeah.
Now, as it happened, it really didn't affect their ability to play all that much. And we still got to play with them a lot after. But we both, you know, knew that changing life circumstance was going to affect our ability to play. And her character was extremely important to the game. So it gave us a deadline. We decided we needed to finish.
Yeah.
Which we did. But.
Well, and I mean, that our gaming group is a perfect example of of this kind of just change. Like, we started playing D&D when we all lived in the same area that I still live in, because I'm holding down the fort until everybody comes back. but we, I mean, that the summer when we really got into D&D, we played like 4 or 5 times a week. Like, it was ridiculous.
Awesome.
Unemployment makes you really just want something to do. And so then we got to play, and then eventually Philip was the first one to break the seal and move away. And so we still played, but it was less frequently because we still wanted to do it around a table. We didn't want to do the digital thing. And then somebody else moved away, and then somebody else, and then people started having kids, and it finally hit a breaking point where it was just like, scheduling was probably the thing that changed the most by virtue of changing life circumstances of like, okay, if we're going to do it, we have to start at this time. We have to be done by this time. We have a very fixed window, and that just causes some, I'm not going to say problems. It just puts a strain on a gaming group.
Mm-hmm.
So we have suffered from that same changing life circumstances kind of making a campaign need to come to an end. And it's sad, but it's not bad. Like,
yeah,
this is a hobby. So,
right.
But I still hate all of you.
So that's the first thing. Most games don't finish, and there's a variety of reasons for that. The next thing is, you will not tie up all the loose ends. If you do end your campaign, there will be plot holes left over. There will be loose ends. Some of this is because there will just not be time, or your players weren't very interested in that plot, or you just forgot.
I mean, the big one for me, if your players don't care about the plot, don't follow the plot. Like, that, so that will definitely happen.
Yeah. So just be okay with that. You're not writing a novel that's going to be criticized and reviewed. You're playing a game. There will be things that you don't get to.
The next thing is burnout. Like, the DM, maybe you, if you're running this game, will finally hit a point where you need a break, or one of your players. I mean, especially if it's a player that's central to your main plot, and they come to you like, I need to take a break. It's like, well, I need to either figure out how to adapt, or we just need to scrap this. And that's happened before. Just burnout's real, and you should not be doing this if you're not having a good time. Don't let it become a job.
Yeah. Then there's writer's block. If you're the DM and you're designing your own story as you go, which we'll talk about that in a minute, but you're designing your own story as you go, you're going to run out of ideas. Now, this is probably the easiest one to overcome, simply because there are so many ways available for you to not write your own adventures. But this is a real thing. And if it really matters to you to write your own adventures, or if you just can't find something out there that you can steal that works, then this could be a problem. This could halt your progress.
Yeah. Speaking of writer's block, collaboration is more important than, I would say, any other game type out there, the long campaign. Because, like we just said, the plot holes and the loose threads, you need to be listening to what your party cares about constantly. A tip that I have for everybody that I do with my gaming groups, I have the players recap what happened last time we played, because that tells me what they remember and what they care about. If I'm sitting there saying this happened, then this happened, then this happened, everybody remember? Okay, good. I don't have any indication of what they care about. And so absolutely ask your party, okay, guys, what happened last time? And write down what they're saying, because Philip and I, in this long campaign we're about to talk about, there were so many things that he and I thought were going to be like huge, big deals to the party. Like, it was going to take them off in another direction. We dropped that bomb and nobody gave a crap. Like, it just fell by the wayside. And we were just like, well, okay. Yeah. And also, because you're playing with this same group of people for such a long time, you're going to learn their expectations and they're going to learn your tendencies as a DM. I mean, Philip and I have that a lot from playing together. I mean, we've been playing together our entire D&D careers. And so we know how the other is both a DM and a player. And use that to your advantage. Like, when it comes to a storytelling, you're not trying to win D&D. Don't take it that way. as a storyteller, use that to your advantage. If you know a player is going to think that you are doing this thing when you start them down this path, swerve on them. And you'll catch them off guard, and they won't want to talk to you after you're done playing, and they'll just get in their car and drive back to Texas without a goodbye. Next week on Eberron Renewed.
Right, I was going to say.
So, yeah.
Yeah. So those are just some things that you need to keep in mind. You need to know before you start trying to do this or before you find yourself trying to do this. Just realize these things and modulate your expectations. All right. So, talked about writing a minute ago. Last thing to talk about before we get into actually talking about our campaign is, how do you design the campaign? Published adventures versus writing your own stuff. And the simple version of the answer is both.
Yeah.
I think that we incorporated all but two of the published Eberron adventures that we could find into our campaign. And I can think of two that I knew about that we didn't end up incorporating.
And that's just because we started with the third one, right? Like, the first two were just, we hit a point where we were over level, if I remember correctly.
Oh, the first, the first couple sessions of our game were things that I and Brad made up, because initially neither you nor I were running this thing.
Yeah. This was the brainchild of someone else.
Yeah. So the first couple were just things that we made up. So the story behind this is funny to me. I used to live in one town and commute about 50 minutes to my job. And I'm a teacher, and I had an after school responsibility that took place in the evening. And it was too soon for me to drive home and drive back. It was pointless. So I stayed in town. I went and ate at this burger place, and across the street from this burger place was a Half Price Books. So I'd get out of school, go to the Half Price Books, spend the amount of time until it was a reasonable hour for me to eat, walking around, and then go across the street and eat dinner. While walking around, I found that there were books about Eberron.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't know that. we were just into D&D. I didn't know anything about previous editions of D&D. I had the fourth edition Eberron campaign setting, but I didn't know that there were all of these books from previous settings. And I found Sharn City of Towers, and I found Whispers of the Vampire Blade. And I bought them and went across the street and read them while I ate my burger. Well, I read Whispers of the Vampire Blade. Sharn City of Towers is like 500 pages long. I immediately knew that was what we're running next. Like, that's what I'm doing next. I don't care what else we're doing. We're stopping. That's what I'm doing next.
Yeah.
And from that point on, we scavenged everything we could. We plundered ruthlessly,
mm-hmm.
And hacked it into our game.
Yeah.
So we wrote plenty of adventures. Both of us did. But I would say don't try to write the whole thing yourself. We've said that many times, and it doesn't need us to go into all the benefits of stealing, but
well, and I will say the manner in which we went about it, I think, is a really good way to take it. If you want to quote unquote write your own campaign, what we really did in this campaign, I feel like, if I'm remembering correctly, we started out doing the pre-published stuff, Whispers of the Vampire Queen, and then the Voyage of the Golden Dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And really after that, we started borrowing and adapting things that we found in other books until probably post level 12 or 13, we were just going whole cloth with it. We might pull encounters here and there, but the story was ours. And that's not a bad way to go about it, because you present these plot threads for your players through pre-published adventures. Mm-hmm. So you're not having to write all these plot lines just for the possibility of your players not caring about them. The stuff they find interesting, that's your through line. And you can eventually kind of wean yourself off of pre-published adventures over time, because you're customizing the campaign to your party. And so then by the time you're hitting that high level stuff 2 years into the campaign, that's the point where you're writing everything, because you really know what your party is interested in and what the narrative of your campaign is at that point. At level one, mm-hmm. you should not know the entire narrative of your campaign. We'll get into that when we cover our sequel campaign.
Right.
you should allow the players to do that. But as DMs, Philip and I both can sympathize with the DM out there that spends a lot of time crafting the early stages of a campaign only for your players to not care about the story you want to tell. So it's a good idea to start your campaign with some pre-published stuff that fits the tone and themes that you're going for, and then just go from there. So,
yeah. Well, all right. So, Unfinished Wars.
Ba-ba-ba-ba.
Our ironically completed campaign.
Yes.
All right. So okay. Let me put this out there. If you find yourself really interested in this and you want to examine all the stuff we did, if you search for Unfinished Wars on Obsidian Portal, you will find our campaign.
Yeah.
It's still there. I've never taken it down. Characters are still up. The session summaries, I mean, it's not organized in any comprehensible fashion to someone who didn't play in it.
Yeah, it's definitely made for us.
You can read all of our forum-based role-playing, as long as you never say anything to me about it at all.
you can talk to me. I'll
yes. Comments, criticisms, rule of thumb for the Geek Pantheon. Comments, criticisms, things like that. Go to Eric and to Jeff. You can say nice things to me if you must. I'm still very insecure about the fact that anyone's paying any attention to this.
And now that Phillip's just got done putting a giant target on himself, let's move on.
Anyway, so if you want to know more about this in more detail, feel free to check out our Obsidian Portal stuff. Examples of a lot of the things we're going to mention are there. So a quick summary of a 3-year campaign. The characters, who I'll introduce, we'll introduce here in a moment, started out in a made-up city that our friend Brad made up in the Lazar Principalities, called 99, for the 99 towers of its walls. And we got double-crossed and forced to flee the city. Fled the city aboard the Tranquility airship, crewed by the cast of Firefly, and went into the employ of a contract from the King of Breland that sent us to Droum, where we met the first of our long-running villains, Alihanna, an Eladrin sorceress who was the nemesis of one of our characters. Chasing her took us into the Feywild briefly, where we met the next important NPC, soon to be a PC, Gualcavad, a ranger, apparently.
Mm-hmm.
Working for Breland, and found out that Alihanna was involved with someone called Calderas trying to unlock the Fae spires that are stuck in Eberron. See the Eberron campaign setting if that doesn't mean anything for you.
Yeah.
Don't worry about it. It turns out to not be very important. See threads your players won't care very much about. So that was the first big arc before I discovered Whispers of the Vampire Blade.
Yes.
So we got out of the Feywild and got contracted by the Citadel to play through Whispers of the Vampire Blade, which is all about tracking down a rogue Citadel agent who's become a vampire. Dun, dun, dun.
Yes.
Enter the next of our recurring villains, Lucan. So that brought us up to Whispers of the Vampire Blade and introduced.
And it also introduced. Was that where the introduction of Evil Rathor came in? He got bit by Lucan?
Yes. So speaking of plot twists, go ahead. Please tell this part. This is great.
So this is another example of just unintended things becoming a big deal in your campaign because you listen to your players. One of our players is playing a Deva wizard named Rathor, and Lucan being a vampire, during this adventure, Rathor failed his check and got bit. And because he's a Deva, we decided that if a Deva is turned undead, that counts as death, and so they would resurrect. And so, essentially, his character got split in two, with him continuing to control the new, quote-unquote, still good Rathor, while the character that he was playing up until that moment fled off into the night as evil Rathor.
Things were more interesting from that, because for a while, he continued to play evil Rathor.
Oh, yeah.
With the goal of forcing us to kill him.
Yes.
Which he eventually did through just an awesome bit of role playing on that player's part. So that ended Whispers of the Vampire Blade. And then we go Voyage of the Golden Dragon.
Yeah. Next up, we did Voyage of the Golden Dragon, which we actually had a player join our party, the Randy, who's on Eberron Renewed. This was his first adventure. So, yes, the party was contracted by the Breelish government to provide security on the maiden voyage of a new cruise ship, the Golden Dragon, piloted by somebody that would become an important NPC and later a PC, Alistair. But yeah, I mean, pretty standard scenario starting out, goblins attack. I don't think, other than the ship and the NPCs that they met, nothing really important narrative-wise came out of this. They basically met the supporting cast on this adventure moving forward.
Mm-hmm. And there was a lot of sort of character bonding that took place. We established a lot more of who the characters were.
Yeah.
But yes, it was mostly a bottle episode, which is what the Voyage of the Golden Dragon is intended to be, and it's magnificent.
Yes. So yeah, that really kind of that was the adventure where I would say the party became the party. Like they mm-hmm. galvanized and came closer together, and there wasn't really an issue of internal trust moving forward past this adventure. Except for the fact that we had a vampire in our midst that wanted us to kill him. And then New Kyre.
New Kyre. So that would be that's the ghoul thing.
Okay.
So the players go to New Kyre from there, having been invited by the Citadel to go and investigate something strange happening. And in New Kyre, the party, which is very close to the edge of the morning, if you'll recall. If you have been listening to Eberron Renewed, then you know that. They go to another place even closer to the edge of the morning, of the Mornland, called Kinrun, which has been overrun by ghouls. And there's this wonderful horror adventure. Again, this is a borrowed adventure I ran called The Lord of the White Fields or something like that.
Yeah.
Which I adapted for the purpose of this, basically just shortened it. And I think this might have been a Halloween game, and that's why I did this. But in the process of it, they also met a horrible undead vampire lord called Calderus,
who
was a name who had come up before, introducing the third of our major recurring villains. And I guess final, other than our big boss, I guess the final of our big important recurring villains.
Reoccurring, yeah.
Yeah. The players are successful, as usual.
Does Kai have Dawnbringer yet?
Yes, Kai gets Dawnbringer in Whispers of the Vampire Blade.
That's an important thing.
Yes.
So rewind to Whispers of the Vampire Blade.
Sorry, so this is obviously a long time ago, and the order of things is going to take.
We're currently in 2010 for those following along at home, so bear right. with us.
So it's been a while. Apologies. Yes, important thing. I suppose we should probably talk a little bit about Kai for a moment, even though we're not in the character section of our notes. But Kai is a tiefling paladin played by our friend Brad. Brad's a big personality. He likes his characters to be big personalities. And he had this image of Kai as sort of the coming queen for her people. Like the tieflings don't really have their own place other than under subjugation of demons elsewhere. His idea was to have Kai become the leader of her people and create a home for them. And he also, you know, if he was going to be the King Arthur person, he wants the King Arthur sword. So in the process of Whispers of the Vampire Blade, there's an airship crash. And a character, a minor NPC that they had met on their airship, is an elf paladin with this awesome sword. And that elf paladin is killed in the crash. And Kai finds and takes the sword, Dawnbringer. This becomes really important. Eric and I weren't really sure why it was important yet, but it was going to become very important.
Yes.
Because not very long after, the sword starts talking to Kai. But in a much less creepy way than in Everrealm Renewed.
I mean, a faceless, shadowy figure speaks to her in her dreams. I mean, yeah, you know, it's not quite in real time. But
it doesn't talk like this.
You don't know. All the talking was done via text, so it was...
That's fair. And basically turns Kai on to who the villain, the ultimate villain, the ultimate danger is.
Yes.
And that is Erandis Vol, who me and Eric had by this point kind of decided we wanted to lead things towards a confrontation with.
Yeah.
But mostly that's all that they found that, well, really, that Kai found out. No one else really knew much about that. But Calderus claims the same house name when they meet him, attaching himself to that, and the players return victorious to New Kyre, whence they are summoned to meet up with their buddy Gwalkavad.
Mm-hmm. And Telelotar goes away for a while.
Yes, Telelotar, yeah. So they spend the winter in New Kyre, and Telelotar kind of goes...
crazy.
Yeah.
Just he was the dark, broody type of character. We'll get into it when we talk characters.
Also related to Telelotar, we had introduced Hadith Irwinarn as a friendly character in this game, an NPC that some of the players built some relationships with. Telelotar mostly. This is another thread that the players really didn't latch onto.
Yeah.
But
Nobody cared that my character was going off to protect this lady. Or join an even more secret version of the King's Citadel. Nobody cared. So
it's true.
Spoiler alert, Telelotar eventually dies because nobody cared. So
at this point, the party are asked to come and join Gwalkavad, who they found out might not be his real name. Because another NPC refers to him as, who works for the Citadel, refers to him as Summerhawk.
Mm-hmm.
And the party begins to work out that Gwalkavad works for the Dark Lanterns and that they don't know as much about him as they thought they were. By this point, Gwalkavad had become my player character.
Yeah.
My initial player character had been abandoned and I decided to play this guy. And so Summerhawk becomes my player character and they're off to meet him. But he's been kidnapped.
Bum, bum, bum.
And is in mortal danger because he's been sent to the Dreadhold. The Alcatraz of Eperon.
Yes. So Telelotar didn't go away because you were DMing this. So
yeah, I DM'd this.
Yeah. So the Dreadhold. Oof. It was a rough night for Philip. But
we've talked about this session too.
We have covered this session. We were supposed to go down. We went up. We found the deposed king of Karnath. And killed the warden.
But didn't actually get to him first, like you found, but he was being spirited away by the Emerald Claw by that point.
Killed the warden, took the secret door, and then went back down and found Gwalkavad after we had basically destroyed the Dreadhold.
Then went down into the slave pits
and then
to find him.
Placed a relative of Kai's brother-in-law as the new leader of the Dreadhold because we are just nepotistic as all get out.
We really are. A couple of important things happened down in the Dreadhold, though. One is we introduced three important NPCs, more supporting cast.
Yes.
Three other tieflings, one of whom doesn't ever talk, and that was just funny to us at first. One of whom is a mad scientist
with a crazy Russian accent.
Yes. and
a lady one, right?
She was like the face of the group. Like she was the straight man of the trio.
Yep.
One of them had to be normal. the party goes to rescue Gwalkvad. This involves a few key events. One is the meeting of a dragon. The dragon Vissilthar.
Oh, yes.
Who is attached to these three tieflings somehow. And Vissilthar has been waiting for Kai. Because, as I said, Brad liked the idea of a character with a big destiny. And so we came up with an awesome thing. Because a while back when we were creating characters, Brad really wanted a dragon mark, but there just aren't tieflings with dragon marks. And he didn't want an aberrant dragon mark. So we said no. As a DM, by the way, you're allowed to do that.
Yeah.
But we decided to do something cool.
That's the important second word. No, yes. But.
Yes. And you couldn't say but to Brad at the time because that would have ruined
it.
This dragon, Vissilthar, is obsessed with the prophecy, and she's very interested in the dragon marks and why they are the way they are. And we decided that what she believed was that the destruction of dragon marks was bad. And so the destruction of the mark of death was bad. And we decided there might have been other dragon marks besides the mark of death. And one of those was the mark of command. And Vissilthar's purpose was to bring back all the lost marks. The party didn't know that all of this yet, but we had decided this, that she was going to be an important behind-the-scenes NPC. And so she carved a dragon mark onto Kai's face.
Yes.
And it worked and became the mark of command. And so we gave her a dragon mark. Then, in finding Gwalkavad and rescuing him...
From a mind flayer.
Annie. From a mind flayer, yes, who drove Telelotar insane.
Yes.
More.
Once again.
Yeah, this was... Yeah.
By this point, Telelotar has been bitten twice by a vampire, had his mind taken over by an intelligent sword, and had his mind entered by a mind flayer. So, just to keep track of where he's at.
Yeah, he's having a bad day. Annie, our halfling cleric of House Churrasco, has her mark appear.
Yeah.
In the Dreadhold. And so that's the other important thing.
So... We go into the Mornland next because the prime minister, or just a high-ranking senator of Breland, Rukinir Klarn, asked the party to do it. And because I wasn't a really good GM yet, the party kind of shrugged and was like, well, this is clearly what we're supposed to do, so let's go do it.
But also because we just wanted to go to the Mornland.
Yes.
So we made up an excuse.
So he gives them the mission. He gives them an artifact known as the Dragon's Eye, which is supposed to be able to subdue a dragon. And they are supposed to go into the Mornland to find a dragon that lives there and bring the dragon back to Rukin. Those of you that have experienced literally any form of storytelling can tell where this is going. The party manages to do that, but also it was discovered that Rathur, in his vampiric form, had begun hunting children in New Kyre. And so this was all done via roleplay on the forums on Obsidian Portal, which we'll get into that.
Yeah.
But Philip's character, Summerhawk, found it out, chased him down. He killed Rathur, and then Rathor transformed into a Rakshasa and fled off. But I would say long term, we actually ended up deciding he did not look like a Rakshasa. He looked exactly like Rathor, but with a goatee, because he was evil Rathor. So yes, and the party also found out that Annie's dad had placed a giant bounty on her head.
Yes. We'll talk about that when we get to the role playing, I think, because some really cool things happen with the role playing.
Yes. Oh, and also because as I was DMing this or preparing to, I realized the party needs a guide through the Mornland because none of them have ever been there before. Why would you go there? And I remembered on Voyage of the Golden Dragon, there was a guy on there who was a like very flamboyant, over the top Indiana Jones style adventurer. So we have a returning NPC coming in to assist the party in their adventures. Once again, building those threads and those relationships. So
the party succeeds. There's lots of danger and horrible, but the party succeeds. Yeah. They capture the dragon, which gets basically sucked into this ball.
Yeah,
it's basically a Pokeball.
Yep.
We didn't even make that artifact up, by the way. If you think that it's lame that there's basically a Pokeball option for dragons, that's not on us.
Yeah.
And we take it back to Rukin, and then we spend the winter in Nukyre, and a bunch of really important character things happen. We'll talk about the role play thing.
I'm going to say the next big thing that happens in the campaign
is the big thing.
Yeah. We unwittingly gave a very evil man who was actually, was he under mind control or no? Yes.
We never decided, I think,
okay,
whether he was actually being dominated.
we had talked about Rukin being dominated by Calderas and or Lucan, or not, him just being an evil son of a bitch. But he uses the Pokeball to release Haze of Death, the name of the dragon that we gathered from the Mornland, to kill the king of Breland. And also, just by virtue of the way the combat went, his trusted bodyguard 3, the Warforged Paladin.
Cool session, by the way, and kudos to me. I had the players.
I was about to say Philip had a really cool idea for this, but nope, you just go ahead and take your own horn and toot it.
I had the players play the king, his bodyguard, his brother, the captain of the Citadel,
Hadith
Irwinarn, who was revealed as a powerful magic user, and Caius?
Yes. Yeah.
The king of Karnath, who was also there. It was a big celebration, a big to-do.
Well, it was the day of mourning, so not really a celebration, a memorial.
Memorial event. So the dragon kills the king, and 3, and I think, I don't remember who killed the dragon, but then the dragon dies, so it worked really well. But, twist, Eric, go!
The party was framed for the murder.
Da, 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 da.
Yes, while all this was going on, the party was chasing a cloaked figure that they saw perform terrible thing or do something shady, basically.
Mm-hmm.
But the party is the finger is pointed at them, and
they're imprisoned. Summerhawk is forced to go rogue and do a jailbreak. We steal the golden dragon with the assistance of Alistair.
Yes.
The captain and flamboyantly wonderful NPC.
Mm-hmm.
And escape and flee to Stormreach.
Ba, 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 ba. And
which
this
I
is
realize. Anyway.
And this is really where Act 1 of the campaign ended.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, we are. It's about a year and a half into the campaign.
Mm-hmm.
About a year.
And this is the point at which we switched to
Pathfinder.
And this is the point at which we really stopped relying on published stuff.
Yeah. And so
other than source books, published adventures.
So then after we arrive
the whole arc in Stormreach, basically.
Yeah. They meet the Avengers. It's really cool. It's a fun shift in tone.
Yeah.
Because it had been political intrigue, really terrible stuff, just bad thing. And so the Stormreach arc was not only fun tonally, but it also provided some opportunities to give the party some wins.
Mm-hmm. Which because, they needed badly.
Yes. And
the players, it, I mean. The players needed it.
And the reason we went to Stormreach, other than it being a really cool location, it removed the party from the center of influence for the campaign, so they could have meaningful and significant wins without derailing the campaign. That's something that you should do, is provide your party the opportunity to have these really big monumental victories that feel significant to them, but you know the villain's over in another part of the world, so it's not really a big deal. Mm-hmm. You should not tell the players that, like, when they're celebrating the table, be like, you guys have no idea, this means nothing. So Stormreach was a lot of fun. Just kind of became pulpy adventure stuff until Calderas tried to open a planar rift to Mabar.
Yes.
That was really
under Stormreach.
Yeah, that was really the end of the fun.
Yeah, so we went into I DM'd this, and this was a big stretch for me because I created an entire dungeon, which I'm not good at. We'll probably do an episode on the fact that I'm not good at that sometime. Actually, that's probably the third episode in this series, because me and Eric are going to try to solve a problem I have.
Yeah.
Created this big ziggurat underneath. They went down, and I did two cool things here. One is I introduced Calderas's daughters, one of whom the players – I made sure the players sympathized with.
Yeah.
And she was cool and honorable and all that. Then I introduced where Calderas came from. He came from the Umbrigen elves of Kyber, essentially, Drow. And that he had become a vampire to be an eternal guardian of his people against this horrible thing that had destroyed them.
Yeah.
And that it was Vol, Lady Vol, who'd woken him. So he was, again, introduced some sympathy for the devil. And then the last thing is they had to side with him to defeat this horrible shadow dragon that attacked them. And so I sort of twisted that around a little bit, and then he escaped into Mabar. But before all that happened, we have a bridge fight and our first player character death. This was decided. This was obviously a moment
at the table. Yeah, at the table.
It wasn't ahead of time, but there was obviously a moment in the fight where I, knowing Eric well enough, knew that he had decided Tel-El-Lothar was going to die here.
Yeah.
And so we went with it. The party ran. Tel-El-Lothar stayed on the bridge to hold off this horrible monster who had come around, because I decided that they had worked out that planar magic worked weird here.
Yeah.
And someone
our wizard was high enough. Well, okay. Our wizard had broken the game for a certain window of time, and this fell into it.
Yep.
Where we made the switch to Pathfinder. And he just figured he could have all of the abilities he had in 4th edition, so he just picked and chose all of the spells that reflected his 4E abilities rather than following the rules for spellcasting. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, anyway.
So he did a plane shift or something. He did some kind of plane opening.
Open planar door or whatever, yeah.
Which I had warned them. I mean, I had made it very clear that they had figured this out before. And I rolled on a table to see what came through. And I rolled Shadow Hulk, which is an Umber Hulk, but worse.
Yes.
And Tel-El-Lothar held the bridge and basically jumped on the Shadow Hulk and rode it off the bridge and fell into a chasm and died.
Yes.
Awesomely. Which, whenever we do a player character death episode, we'll talk about the importance of that. But
yeah.
So Tel-El-Lothar escapes. Meanwhile, on the surface, there's been an attack on the Iranian embassy. An ambassador's been killed, and Alistair and Amaron get to come face to face with the big bad evil guy for the first time.
Arandis Vol.
Yes.
Which, if you don't know who she is, go read a book. Big bad evil lich lady. Then after all of that goes down.
We had to go back to Breland.
Yes.
Because the family because members.
One of our party members was foolish enough to have a family in their backstory.
Two of our party members.
Oh, yeah.
Both Kai and Annie's sisters had been abducted and were basically going to be dressed up as their sisters and executed in a propaganda stunt by the new government of Breland that was secretly being run by vampires.
And also, Bornell's Warforged bodyguard has shown back up for no good reason.
Despite the fact the party knows for a fact he's dead.
Yeah.
So we go back to Breland. This is a really awesome adventure. Eric ran this one. I got to play in it. It's, I don't know, Golden Dragon is probably still my favorite. But this is high on my list because Turnabout's fair play. The party did something extremely unexpected to me in the Dreadhold adventure, and I had to run with it. So I decided to do that to Eric.
Yep.
Basically, my character, Rogue Citadel Agent, I decided he just left the party in the middle of the night before they made their big move to rescue the prisoners and broke into the Prime Minister's place of residence with the intention of killing him. But in the event, actually simply kidnapping him and assuming his identity.
Yeah.
For the duration of the game, of the adventure. And Eric ran with it like a champ. Anyway, it was really fun. The rescue was pulled off. Huzzah, huzzah, huzzah. But Kai's sister's been turned into a vampire. And in order to fix it, we need help from a higher power. So we go to Thrain. We get help from the speaker for the flame. We also find out about a new villain, a new danger of an artifact called the Day Heart, which if you know the lore behind Strahd and Ravenloft, you know what that is.
Yeah.
And we did this because I found a lot of the adventures were inspired by me or Eric obtaining a new book.
Mm-hmm.
And this was no different. So we ran a Ravenloft game in a different plane. And as you know, with planes, time dilation. So Yay. When the party gets back, it's been 3 years.
Yeah, I think so. Yes, looking at the notes, 3 years. Yeah.
So there's a time jump, and this brings us things running to a head. Now we have several important things happen
in quick
succession. Yeah.
Real quick, time with Strahd. This is an important thing to note. We are using a pre-published adventure.
Oh, yeah.
In the middle of our campaign. So we have narratives, we have through lines, we have player investment. So we take a little simple thing. We did not change it was all still in Barovia and all the weird stuff. Strahd is Lady Vol's boyfriend, ex-boyfriend.
Yeah.
Lover. So we did that, and all of a sudden, the whole thing was attached to our campaign. That was all you have to do. And so the fact that my character killed...
Day Heart mattered. But.
Well, yes. But and so it became the fact that my character was the one that killed Strahd. So all of a sudden the big, bad, evil person really hated my character.
Yes.
And so just do that little thing. You can take an adventure you want to run like Curse of Strahd. Everybody loves Curse of Strahd. Everybody wants to run it. Just do that. Attach it in a small but meaningful way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it worked great. The other big thing that happened in that is we played with the idea that we were in a different plane, and one of the big locations in the castle Ravenloft is this chapel of Ravenloft. There's all this raven iconography. So we decided to attach the Raven Queen, the goddess from 4th edition, to that. And Annie, our cleric, who had told me and Eric a long time ago, her player had, that she wanted to start a religion.
Yes.
She managed to make contact with the Raven Queen. With a goddess who doesn't exist in Eberron. And the way in which they killed Strahd caused Barovia to get stuck in Eberron, and we decided that opened a gateway for the Raven Queen to be in Eberron. Mm-hmm. And so Annie is now not just a halfling cleric healer, she's also become a servant of the Raven Queen. So, 3-year jump. We go to Droem. Kai duels Resh Tarakbar the Minotaur and kills him and wins possession of his castle and dedicates it to her people, to a place for her people.
Having Hooray! Accomplished everything that she wanted, which and naturally means. Yep. What could ever go wrong?
This is such a George R. R. Martin thing. It's just...
But it was unintended.
It was.
So.
Yeah.
Go ahead. I want to lead. Is this the next thing that you're going to talk about?
Yeah.
Okay. So here is my defense for one Philip Ledbetter dungeon master. Our party was notoriously paranoid and protective most of the time. In fact, we had a player join our campaign, I think, shortly before this occurring. And like we did the horrible party thing of like, we don't know you, so we're not going to accept you thing. We were just a paranoid group because we were dealing with really world endings type of stuff. And we had been betrayed so many times. So we were never laid back. Like, even in situations where we were protected and resting, we were always on edge. And so we traveled as a group. We rarely split up to this point in the campaign. So we go back to Stormreach, which has become kind of our base of operations. We operate out of Stormreach quite a bit. And just so uncharacteristic of our party, we decide to split up and just go walking around the town.
In fairness to the party,
yes,
if I may, as they're flying in, they see several sites important to them that have been destroyed.
Yes.
This is obviously, I mean, this is a trap.
Yeah.
Right? This is a trap. You know this is a trap. Everyone listening knows this is a trap. And I don't know if the players knew it was a trap or if they just decided they could handle it. But the players, as you said,
split up. And not just into two groups, like into at most pairs. Mm-hmm. If not single party members going to investigate all these different sites. And where did Kai go by herself? She went to Theron's Rest, the Irani consulate in Stormreach. And so, yeah, a villain that we had introduced. This was a reoccurring villain. We just haven't brought him up yet. But the White Raven, who's like, think evil Batman.
He's kind of the leader of the Emerald Claw, which is the terrorist organization attached to Karnath, kind of, in Stormreach. So he had come up.
And so it was a one-on-one fight, and it did not go either's way. Like, to be fair, none of them walked away from it. In a Hail Mary move, Rathor tried to get his Mephit familiar to pull a healing potion off of Kai's belt and give it to her. But I forget what potion he ended up pulling off of there, but it wasn't a healing potion.
Yeah.
So Kai essentially went nuclear with divine energy, blowing herself, the White Raven, and Ruthor's Mephit up and killing all involved.
Yeah.
So
Kai dies at the moment of her greatest accomplishment. It wasn't my intention with the session, but
this was not a moment like the Tel Lothar death where there was a conscious choice made. This was somebody fighting for their life and the dice deciding no. So when we get into player death, we'll do a whole episode dedicated to it and we can really break down this scenario. But moving on.
Yeah. other than that, so the party mourns Kai. It's a big deal. It's a long way in. And while I had liked Tel Lothar, me, Philip, the DM, no one else in the party really had.
Yeah.
And that was not the case with Kai. So we let the party mourn. Annie fully dedicates herself to the Raven Queen. And we move on. And now things rush to a head. The party have, through various means at this point, gathered the necessary things to know where Arandis Foal is headed.
And just because I mentioned earlier we were in 2010, we are now in 2013. We are 3 years removed from the beginning of this campaign.
Yeah. Figure out what her end goal is, effectively. There's some additional stuff that goes on to figure it out, and there's a couple of additional plots that get pulled in with Alistair and the Church of Thrain and Jail of Duran. They kill the High Cardinal of Thrain in a sort of side thing. But rush ahead, and we've talked about the big boss fight here, so I won't go into details of it, but battle ensues on the island of Thronehold, and Arandis Foal is defeated.
Yes.
At least for now.
Bum, bum, Obviously, we brushed over a lot, like pretty much every side story, and just there was a lot of stuff going on. Mm-hmm. Because you have to do that with a long campaign. We were throwing spaghetti at the wall and following the noodles that stuck. Now let's talk about the characters.
Kai, we've really effectively talked about.
Annie was a halfling cleric who was 12.
Yeah. Yeah. That's the other important thing about Annie is she started out very young. In fact, that was one of the reasons for the time jump when we came out of Barovia, is because she had wanted her character to grow up more. But the speed of travel available in Eberron meant that her character just didn't age as much as she kind of wanted her to. So the time jump was partly affected for her benefit, to let her character grow to adulthood a little more.
Yeah. Rathor, our Deva wizard, who is just a wild card constantly.
Mm-hmm. There were at one point three versions of him running around.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think in various campaigns we've run over the years, there are now five.
Yes.
Just because Rathor is a great character that Philip and I like bringing back. Mm-hmm. Amaron Athelfrith was a halfling swashbuckler that was great with the ladies and had a special affinity for drow.
And his ultimate desire was to own a restaurant.
Yes. We also had Aurora, who was a Eladrin warlock.
Yeah.
Pretty similar backstory to Sleeping Beauty.
Exactly the backstory of Sleeping Beauty.
Yes. Ended up with the Prince of New Kyre in the end. Yes. So she got her Prince Charming.
She did. And got to, and frankly, wins the award for coldest retribution.
Yeah.
Part of the end game was she got to come face to face with Alihanna. And what did she decide to do? She basically cut her off from magic.
Instead of killing her,
she just cut her off from magic. And Eladrin being inherently magical beings, that's like hideous.
Yeah, it was real bad. And even everybody at the table was just like, oh, God. Like, nobody was really cheering in that moment, even though it was totally justified.
Yeah, I flipped through and even found, effectively a spell that just made permanent would have that effect. So
it was
crazy. But she gained like mythical powers and became an archfey and all sorts of cool things.
Yeah. Then we had Gwalkavad and Tel Lothar.
Gwalkavad slash Summerhawk slash
Jack slash Gavin.
Mm-hmm.
And then the second characters for myself was Alistair, who was the captain of the Golden Dragon when we met him. And Brad's second character that he got to play for like three sessions. Mm-hmm. That's how late in the game Kai died.
Yeah.
Was over 3 years of playing this character, and we all knew the end of the campaign was in sight. We were going back to Stormreach to restock up to take the fight to Vol.
Yeah.
And he died. But he played an elf rogue named Sayuri.
Yeah. Who was an Irani elf, part of an organization, the Death Guard, who basically were trying to kill Arandis Vol. So he picked a character who could come in late and have a very clear reason to go with the party.
Yeah. Those are all the big player characters. Mm-hmm. There were obviously some important NPCs that came in and out, but we never really had that kind of mentor NPC. We never had that NPC that was more central to the plot than the players, I feel like.
Yeah.
We had Arandis Vol as the big bad evil villain, underlings such as Calderas and Alihanna and mm-hmm. Lucan and Rukin.
Not our fault that those names rhyme, by
yes,
the way.
Yes, that's the source material. What else would you like to talk about in terms of characters?
I think that's a good thing. A couple of important threads that are worth noting here. That we introduced. Annie is on the run from her house because her father views her as a tool because he's a tool.
Waka waka.
And basically just wants to use her to make House Jurasco more money. So she's on the run. Gwalkavad was a a runaway from House Vedalus. We had a lot of house runaways.
Yeah.
Alistair obviously goes rogue from House Larendar and steals the ship.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a bunch of house runaways going on, and so there was a lot of house politicking going on in the background that only kind of got resolved.
Yeah. So I guess why did it work, Philip? Why has every attempt that we've had to recreate this fallen flat on its face?
The first thing I have on the note we've mentioned, so I'll just run over it real fast. We heavily plundered the work of others.
Yes. Like,
we stole adventures. Lots of story arcs were based on the fact that Eric or I picked up a book at half-price books. We ran the Barovia side because I found Expedition to Castle Ravenloft at half-price books.
Yeah.
And ran it. So a lot of it was just improvised. We had the big enemy planned out, but how we got there was mostly based on what resources we had at hand.
Yeah. Another big reason, I would say maybe one of the biggest reasons, is we co-GM'd it.
Yeah.
One of the biggest reasons these long form campaigns die out is GM burnout. It mm-hmm. is a very hard, very thankless job a lot of times. And so it's easy to get burnt out. And fortunately, Philip and I set up a system to where it wasn't even every other adventure. It was when one of us had a story we wanted to tell, when one of us had an idea, we would tag in basically mm-hmm. and tell our story. And it was just kind of the agreement that while the other player was getting to take a break and enjoy playing, they were thinking about the next story. Yeah. And what they wanted to do. And so we would just hop back and forth as we wanted. Mm-hmm. And we were able to talk through ideas. And I mean, we've already gushed about how awesome it is to have a co-GM. So go back and listen to, I think, the second episode if you want to hear that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
I think the next one is we made no assumptions about where we were going when we started. We started because we wanted to play D&D.
Yeah. We didn't have a session zero. We didn't talk to the players beforehand about what type of game they wanted. Basically all the stuff, all the tips we gave you for session zero, we did none of those. But it also lent itself to being able to really hone in on what all the players wanted through watching them play.
Now, session zero would have been helpful.
Yes.
Because we might have avoided some of the character incompatibility things that we ran into a few times.
Yeah.
But on the whole, not sitting down and saying, all right, guys, this is going to be a game that's all about fighting undead stuff.
Yeah.
Because it wasn't. A lot of other things.
Mm-hmm. Well, and also, it's one thing for me as a player, if Philip's running a campaign, for me to say, I want something really noir and gritty and just street-level stuff. And then when we sit down to play, I'm cracking jokes and doing crazy stuff like an Errol Flynn movie. I may say with my mouth that I want a gritty noir game, but if you observe me playing, you see that I enjoy the complete opposite. And so we mm-hmm. were able to, through watching our players play, pick up on what kind of game they wanted to be a part of. So
yeah, that helped a lot.
Also, there was a lot of role playing going on in between sessions because Philip abandoned all of us and moved away. We only got to play at most
once a month.
Yeah. Sometimes there would be a bit more of a gap in there, but in the downtime we would role play on a forum and write back and forth role plays and keep the story alive and moving.
Honestly, I would say that as much character development took place on those forums as off.
Oh yeah.
In places there are a couple of role plays on there that effectively are whole adventures.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, like we talked about, you killing evil Rathor,
mm-hmm.
that was done in a role play. I think we started our next play session with actually rolling out the fight real quick.
Yeah.
But everything leading up to it was role playing.
Yeah. The thing with Annie's dragon-marked house, Annie had decided, you know, I started writing this thing about how in his downtime, Gualcabad, who had developed this sort of little sister view of Annie, was basically just keeping tabs on her father And then in the midst of that, Annie's player interjected Annie's sister also doing the same thing.
Yeah.
And it ended up with Annie's sister apparently being killed. And my character, then I then having to write bringing that news back to her character. And it totally changed my character.
Yeah.
Because I had played him as this very aloof, you know, spy, the job kind of, you know, James Bond kind of thing. And it cracked him. It broke him and it changed the character. So it was magnificent. And if you never tried doing that and you have a group who can't play every week, I really encourage you to try something like this because it made a huge difference in our game.
Yeah. And I mean, a pretty good platform to do it. If you don't want to pay for a subscription or anything like that, make a private Facebook group and post it on there. You can post replies to comments and just have that dialogue tree going on there.
Then Mark Zuckerberg can enjoy reading your game.
Yeah. We also had a changing cast of characters, both in player characters and NPCs, which kept things fresh. I mean, Philip and I started the campaign playing characters named Drakir and Ash. Mm-hmm. And if you're confused that you haven't heard those names, that's because those characters lasted mine lasted a session. And I think yours lasted two or three,
maybe three. Because the reason, and this is really important, it wasn't they got killed. It wasn't anything dramatic. I mean, it was me and Eric didn't like playing them.
Yeah. I was playing a Warforged Bard, realized it wasn't as much fun as I thought it was going to be. So I built Tel Lothar and had Tel Lothar come in and disable him.
Yeah. And Drakir just went off somewhere else.
Yeah.
So especially when you have new players, and I think that is part of it. But honestly, anytime you're starting a campaign, player comes and tells you, look, I'm kind of bored of this character. That's fine.
Yeah. Make a new
especially one. Especially early. It's not a problem. It's not even an inconvenience.
Yeah.
Just change the character out. And your players aren't going to go, wait a minute, it doesn't make narrative sense to introduce that character. No one's going to do that.
Yeah. Tel Lothar literally ran in the middle of a dungeon crawl. It was at the start of the second session where we were still in a dungeon. He just kicked a door in. It was like, ha ha. with a retinue of two other characters that were joining us for the first time in that session. Yeah. So I mentioned this with the Stormreach stuff, changed the tone. Like you don't need to change the themes. You don't need to change your story, but you gotta switch up the tone. I mean, Star Wars has A New Hope, Empire Strikes Back, and Return of the Jedi as part of its original trilogy, which are three films with very differing tones. And that goes into making a good long form story. If it's all dark, all sad, all the party getting beaten down all the time, it's not fun. And while some people may enjoy that in their fiction, if they're a fan of A Song of Ice and Fire, actually quote unquote living that story would suck. Like you don't want to be Sansa. Nobody wants to be Sansa. We introduced the Avengers halfway through our campaign, including.
I feel like we need to expand on that for a moment.
Okay.
So Stormreach has all these militias, and me and Eric bought the book City of Stormreach right before we did this arc. And we sat down and we talked about the militias. And at one point, I have no idea which of us did it. I'm going to give credit to Eric because he ended up being in charge of most of this for us. But he pointed out, you know, this guy kind of sounds like Captain America. And at that point, on, every single one of the militias became a superhero team.
Yeah.
It was not just the Avengers. There was the Avengers. There was the Fantastic Four. We had the X-Men.
The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants.
The Brotherhood of Evil Mutants. Like, it was all of them.
It was we did the Marvel Universe in Stormreach.
Yes.
It was a lot of fun. The players enjoyed it. Annie had Peter Parker following her around trying to flirt with her all the time.
Peter Parker was in it.
And
awesome.
Yeah, so it was a lot of fun. And it didn't take away from the looming threat. But the party really enjoyed it. And at the end of the day, that's important.
Also, in that arc, we took away one of Jack's eyes so that he became more like Nick Fury.
That's very true. Yes. forgot about that.
Jack being Gualcavad / Summerhawk. If you
he was
are
Jack
struggling
at that
to
point.
Keep track, it kept changing.
His real name's Gavin, but nobody yes. ever called him that.
That's right.
So even after we found that out, it was still just Jack.
Yeah.
So yeah, change the tone up. That's going to give your campaign legs to go this kind of distance because it reduces the likelihood of burnout because you're not doing the same thing over and over, and it gives you the freedom as a DM to surprise your party.
Mm-hmm.
And not in a shocking plot twist way, just in a, well, I wasn't expecting a session like that.
Yeah. There were a lot of just comedy sessions. I mean, Eric ran a session where we had to go undercover at a brothel.
Yep.
And it wasn't like lewd or anything. It was in like none of us were really quite comfortable with any kind of anything that was going to go beyond
the most lewd thing
low
that happened.
PG-13.
The most lewd thing that happened was Amaron, our swashbuckling loudmouth halfling, walked up to the front desk and asked, "Do you have a menu?"
I forgot about that.
So that was the worst thing that happened.
It was hilarious. We had sessions where we got into bar fights. We had a very dark, heavy campaign, but we threw as much comedy in there as we could just to give the players a break. You need that moment. I mean, you watch films, you know that you need those moments where there is a bit of a comic break. So the last thing that I think made it work, and we've touched on this a lot, so I won't get into detail about it, is player input. We had so much of this campaign inspired by either things that the players just thought were cool or by things the players said they wanted for their characters. And while me and Eric have groused about the fact that our players had such lofty goals for their characters, it was really helpful and inspiring. I mean, I will admit that Kai's thing was really hard to shoehorn in, but Annie's thing made me think really carefully where she wanted to found a religion. That made me think really carefully about how we could do that. And I like the solution we came up with introducing a new god with Annie as its sort of herald. Rathur's thing was his goal was to experience everything. And that just led to so many hilarious outcomes. And Amaron's really simple goal of buying a restaurant just involved him making enough money and then buying a restaurant. So the goals that the players gave us for themselves inspired a lot of the arcs. And so even though it may sound like a big hassle, and in some cases it was a big hassle to get the players to give you what they want their character arc to be like, I think it really made a lot of fun things happen in our game.
Yeah.
All right. So that's, as far as we can tell, why it worked.
Yeah.
Let's talk and wrap up with some missed opportunities. So the first one on my list is I wish we had slow played more things.
Yeah. That's just me and Philip as DMs a lot of times, but yeah.
We struggle with that because we get excited about it. We want the players to have the payoff. And we want the payoff and we want to see their faces when they figure it out. And so Eric and I have a hard time slow playing things. Probably the last 5 or 6 sessions were just a sprint of finding out everything we needed and going after Vol. And yeah. It probably would have been nice if we could have allowed them to find out some things slightly earlier and just let spread out the gathering everything we need part of it.
Yeah. Go ahead.
The death of Kai, I have some unresolved issues with the death of Kai. Probably we should just save that for an episode on player character death.
I don't think it's a problem. But then again, I wasn't the one rolling the dice to do it. So, yeah. And then pretty much, even though they were very important during the run of the campaign, really none of the Dragonmarked House plot lines were resolved. We just kind of killed Vol and then were like, washed our hands of it. It was like, okay, we're done.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I guess you could say that by that point, the characters were all powerful enough that they were untouchable by the Dragonmarked houses, but we never really resolved that. It was all just sort of left up in the air.
So, and We acknowledge that, though, in our post-mortem when Philip and I sort of talked about the campaign. And so we decided to resolve that with a sequel titled The Mark of Vengeance.
Da-da-da-da.
The sequels are never as good as the original.
Yeah. And a lot of times they go into development limbo and get a bunch of writing changes and the script keeps getting rewritten
or sometimes the original was so good that the guys that created it just get stuck up their own ass about what great storytellers they are. So
that happens, you know. Too. So tune in next time as we examine an entirely unsuccessful campaign. You will notice from our storytelling that there's not a really like clean, clear arc to this campaign.
No.
It pains me to say it, but I think that's one of its virtues.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I really wanted a clean, clear arc, but I think it's one of the virtues that it didn't have that we just improvised, because really until 8th or 9th level, I don't think we realized that we knew where we wanted to go.
Well, and I will say, like, you hear this criticism of a lot of films or books that have kind of disjointed storylines and plot holes and loose threads where it feels like it was done by committee. It's everybody expressing their own opinion and you have this disjointed work. That's D&D. It's storytelling by committee. You're not writing a novel. So do not be upset when your campaign doesn't have a clear through line narrative. And so, yeah, don't be discouraged when you look at your campaign and you're just like, this is a mess. So also next time when we discuss The Mark of Vengeance, it will be a much shorter episode. Thank you for sticking with us this long.
Yes.
Because unlike the 3 years this campaign lasted, the sequel lasted 3 sessions. So maybe a bit more, but not very many.
No,
so,
not very much.
We spent more time planning it than we spent playing it. So yeah, anything else you'd like to say to the people, Philip?
No, I mean, thanks for listening. I hope you found this entertaining, and we'll look at me and Eric getting too high on our own talent, or luck, I guess, as it kind of looks when you analyze it this way.
When Eric and Philip forgot that there were like 6 other storytellers sitting around the table helping them do this campaign and decided to do it on their own. Yeah. And also, I don't have a lot, but if you are really interested in this campaign and there was some plot thread we mentioned that really sparked your interest, I think Philip has a lot of notes still from campaign. So if you want some more info on an NPC or a plot thread or something, let us know and we can get you some of that info.
I did almost all my planning for this in handwritten notes, so I've still got most of it.
Yeah. So yes, thank you all so much for listening. We hope that this was informative and engaging and fun for you. So yeah, we will talk to you next time.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye.